Last night we got into the theme, ethical issues arising in contemporary life, and instead of trying to cover the whole waterfront of contemporary life and issues evoked thereby, I came down on one of the areas in which the anguish of ethical decision is most dramatically manifest. That is, in the contemporary practice of medicine. And I felt last night that my final statement, that the ethical decision has now moved from obedience to clear ethical rules and laws or principles, the locus of the ethical decision has moved more and more into the area of judgment within quite particular situations, which creates a burden for the ethical, which we are not accustomed to. We're not accustomed in such solitary nakedness to have to confront ethical issues for which we can find no certain word of God or church or ethical philosophy. Now, in order to dramatize that point even more clearly to some of you, I've asked a physician who is one of us here this week to read for us right now a case study, a brief case study in which this thing is very clearly put, and I'll ask him to come to the podium where the microphone is alive and read it from there. Will you introduce yourself?
Thank you, Dr. Sittler. I'm Earl Kamuk, Mount Vernon, Washington, and a surgeon by specialty. I will read one case and very briefly summarize a second case. Both concern infant death. Both are recorded in an article by Richard McCormick in the Journal of the American Medical Association, July 1974. On February 24th, the son of Mr. and Mrs. Robert T. Houle died following court-ordered emergency surgery at Maine Medical Center. The child was born February 9th, severely deformed. His entire left side was malformed. He had no left eye, was practically without a left ear, had a deformed left hand. Some of his vertebrae were not fused. Furthermore, he was afflicted with a tracheoesophageal fistula and could not be fed by mouth. This is an abnormal opening between the windpipe and the passageway for food between the mouth and the stomach. Anything given by mouth would end up in the lungs and rapidly lead to demise. Air leaked into his stomach instead of going to the lungs, and fluid from the stomach pushed up into the lungs. As the days passed, the condition of the child deteriorated. Pneumonia set in. His reflexes became impaired, and because of poor circulation, severe brain damage was suspected. The tracheoesophageal fistula, the immediate threat to his survival, can be corrected with relative ease by surgery. But in view of the associated complications and deformities, the parents refused their consent to surgery on baby boy Houle. Several doctors in the Maine Medical Center felt differently and took the case to court. Maine Superior Court Judge David G. Roberts ordered the surgery to be performed. He ruled, at the moment of live birth, there does exist a human being entitled to the fullest protection of the law. The most basic right enjoyed by every human being is the right to life itself. The second case occurred 3 years previously at that mecca of medicine, particularly specialized medicine, John Hopkins Hospital. In this case, an infant was born with the Down syndrome and duodenal atresia. The Down syndrome is mongolism, a mental deficiency. Duodenal atresia is a failure of the intestine to develop a passageway from the stomach to the intestine further down the course of the intestine. After consultation with advisors, the parents refused permission for this corrective surgery, and the child died by starvation in the hospital after 15 days. Mongolism is not a threat to life. duodenal atresia can be corrected by surgery.
These two cases, I think, are enough to make adequately clear the truth of the statement that by virtue of modern medicine and surgery, pharmacology, things are possible which even a generation ago were not possible, and survival can be maintained by means which were not available to our parents, and life can be continued into stages where what normal signals of fully intelligent life are no longer present, yet a viable biological organism is still there and breathing and the heart is working. Now, as you know from the popular literature as well as from technical journals, this has raised a number of issues in which quite new definitions are required. A definition of death: there is no longer a single or simple or universally accepted definition of death, just as there is no universal definition, even among the biologists, of life itself. So that the meaning of the sustained life, whether it has a meaning, when its apparent meaninglessness may by a judgment be so assessed as to make the termination of that life a reasonable and acceptable act. These are problems which the previous generation simply did not have to face. Not only are these ethical problems of a kind that were not previously faced, but the modes of ethical thought, the accumulated habits of ethical action, the sense for what is right, all of these has become so complex and so different in individual circumstances that the application even of a universal rule, if such could be achieved, would be highly inappropriate in individual cases. Now, given that situation, your generation, you younger ones, your generation is in for a very radical rethinking of fundamental terms in not only in Christian theology, but in all of human experience. Life, meaning, death, purpose, community, selfhood, personhood. These realities and concepts have developed a kind of solid tradition of meaning over the centuries, but the tumultuous and convulsive changes, probably led by scientific work, which then leaks back into emotional life, into issues in family life, what we call lifestyle, these are now pressing upon the Christian community with particular force. Now, I have only time to say a bit about one man who's working very hard in this field to try to generate a way to think Christianly ethically in the middle of this kind of a problem. It was from the article by Father Robert McCormick, professor of moral philosophy at the Catholic University of America, that the doctor read. Father McCormick has several statements in the article, the title of which and the place of its publication you may get at the end of the session if you like. Two points he makes. First of all, when the center of the judgment is now put upon the person or the family or the little community of family, doctors around the case, when that happens, what are the leading components that must enter into the judgment? Two I want to highlight. First, the notion that life in itself is the highest value. Now that cliche, as the Germans say, es klingt so wunderlich, it sounds so wonderful, that it often is accepted uncritically. And yet it takes only a moment's reflection to know that we really do not believe that. Life itself is not the highest value, for we all know there are things which have a value for the sake of which higher value we are willing to give our life. When we say of a certain case, life is not worth living, we have already by indirection postulated that there are values beyond biological life, under the weight or the force of which life itself is relativized. When we say in the old Latin motto, dulce et decorum est pro patri mori, beautiful and noble it is to give one's life for his country. That's no longer very persuasive given the recent war. But men and women have given their lives for what they call my country. They don't mean just a piece of real estate, but the accumulated centuries of tradition, familiarity, beauty, promise, which constitute one's people. And the highest value of all is certainly the spiritual value, the realization of one's personhood in relationship to the fountain of life itself. And therefore, when we know that life itself as a sheer biological, anatomical datum is not the highest principle, that the spiritual end of life, from everybody from Augustine, St. Thomas Aquinas, and Luther affirmed this, the spiritual ends of life are the ultimate value, how then shall we say, when a situation makes any longer appreciable, relatable, receivable, those spiritual appreciations and identities which constitute the highest value? When that occurs, then perhaps it is ethical that an illness should be permitted without the use of extraordinary means to go on to its end. That is, as even Pope Pius XII said, when a body in illness or accident has indicated that death is imminent, it is not morally reprehensible if extraordinary means are not used. Now that's from a very high authority, at least in one part of the Holy Catholic Church. Now, let's get at this another way. What do we mean by life having a meaning which is able to be congruent with the spiritual end of life and man's highest identity, the imago Dei, the image of God? Our lives are profoundly constituted by their relationships. If I ask you who you are, you do not begin to answer my question by unlocking your private identity. You give me in reply a bundle of relations. My father was so-and-so, my mother was so-and-so. I was born here or there. I went to school here or there. My work in life is as follows. The community I live with is as follows. What you do, you answer a question of privacy by a social answer. We spin out a whole web of meaningful relationships, and what we call our selfhood is the focal point where all these relationships cross our recognizing solitude. So that meaningful life is a life in which relationships are recognizable, receivable, lived in, appreciated, enjoyed, and even perhaps contributed to as enrichment. When, therefore, a life has come to the point where these meaning-bestowing and sustaining relationships are no longer possible, when simply the neurological and physiological system is no longer able to sustain the kind of material basis for thought, reflection, recognition, then we might say that in a certain sense these diminishments have become so radical that life is no longer a value to the person who bears the name of the patient. Now with that, that's all I'm going to say about that, because I have another big task to do tonight, and I make no pretense of solving anything, but simply calling the attention of my fellow pastors and teachers and lay folk in the church to the fact that we are indeed moving into a time in which older ways of of recognizing problems, probing for solutions, are no longer adequate to the magnitude of the problems themselves. And therefore we must reach back into the Christian tradition and probe its riches to find where we might find, in the Word of God, in the tradition of the people of God, ways of thinking which we may not say are identical with the will of God. I don't think we are able to do that. But which, as the old prayer preceding communion says, not as we ought, but as we are able, with the fullest of our ability, offer these reflective, devout judgments to God, as not perhaps as we ought, when we cannot know what we ought, but as we are able. Now that's all I'm going to say about it, except that I hope all of you begin to look into the very considerable literature that is already existing, much of it kitsch, and purely for popular consumption to titillate the eagerness of a banal population. But a lot of it is very responsible analysis, such as Robert McCormick, who is both knowledgeably related to the practice of medicine and also a well-trained theologian and biblical scholar. Now, I want to move to the other thing that I had not intended to talk about, but which several conversations on the campus here during these last several days have caused me to feel that I ought. As I said to Dr. Pilgrim, it would not do to come to a conference made up of the kind of people who come to Holden Village with what he intends to say firmly locked up in his pocket, because the input one gets from the hearers is often so provocative that they incite you to reach back into other things you have reflected about and do the best you can with what your hearers have put on the front burner. So I want to get at that second topic, which I won't give a name to, by the following steps. First of all, and for the first time I have to try to read what I wrote, first of all, let me accent again a point I touched briefly the other day. I think it was a certain historian in our country, Fletcher, who some years ago wrote that when the history of the 19th and 20th centuries is written hundreds of years from now, when a long perspective shall have been achieved, it will be seen, he thinks, that the most massive revolution that's taken place has been caused by the growth and refinement of man's transactions with the natural world. Now, what I mean by these transactions is well known to you. Ever since the 17th century, in the realm of geology, biology, anthropology, physiology, all these fields, men have turned to look at the structure and the process of the natural world as to be able so to understand it, or sufficiently understand it, as to create what we call the modern sciences. And these sciences have not been simply laboratory or speculative sciences. They have spun off with increasing rapidity into technological actualizations of their new knowledge. Back of every gadget or machine or computer or whatnot is a highly abstract new understanding of the world of nature. Now I think it's true then to say, how profound, but certainly very profoundly, all of us are creatures of these several hundred years since Galileo, these several hundred years in which we have come to be a people deeply formed by man's transactions with the world as nature and even the world as history, in terms of the work of Karl Marx, with new understanding of the dynamics of human society, Freud, with fresh understanding of the dynamics of personhood, familial life, and so forth. So that these transactions have in a sense constituted us very deeply, whether we fully understand the steps of them or not. Now it's because of these transactions that we've developed a kind of new language, or, to put it another way, certain kinds of language which represent the way things are. Certain kinds of language have become very common and understandable. Other kinds of language have become quietly evaporating. There are two kinds of language commonly. There is designative speech and evocative speech. Designative speech is the kind that simply that the pharmacist uses. When you take your physician's prescription and the pharmacist reads it, he knows what it means and what's to go in there, and then he writes the label for you, take 1-3 times a day. That is not metaphysical or social or poetic language. That is purely designative language. Or when I say, the door is open, that is not philosophical speech. That's designative repertorial speech of an empirical fact. So that designative language constitutes the reigning language of our time. You look at the ordinary college catalog, even for a liberal arts college, and see the way in which the disciplines of study which use designative language have grown and grown and grown. And the student, at least in the liberal arts college, is obliged to take 1 or 2, perhaps 3 courses in literature, or in religion, or in history, in which evocative language is the kind of language that's used. What do I mean by evocative language? In the little poem I quoted last night from Walter de la Mare, so lovely in this setting, when he talks about the little brook that runs out back of here, says, very old are the brooks, and the rills that rise where snow sleeps cold beneath the azure skies sing such a song of come and gone, their every drop is wise as Solomon. That's not marine biology. That's not hydrographic talk. He is using the metaphor of a brook that rises afar off in the mysterious highlands and goes to the distant sea. He's using that metaphor of something clear and visible to evoke from you a picture of the pathos of human existence, which moves from a far-off beginning through the episodes of existence into a far-off ending. Now that's evocative language. This is the language of the Christian faith. Not only that language, but the fundamental language of the Christian faith. The Holy One, blessed be He, righteousness, the Spirit, forgiveness, love, and above all, God Himself. This is a language which has an evocative, not simply a designative character. Now we live in a time when the proclamation of the Christian gospel is more and more difficult because the traditionally rich and living language of its emergence, of its nurturing, that language has either been violently destroyed or is going silently out of mind. So that when you have to preach a sermon now to make clear to your people what the phrase from the liturgy, therefore with angels and archangels and all the company of heaven we laud and magnify thy glorious name, that's loaded with symbols, metaphors, images of personages in the biblical drama, which are no longer just instantly recognizable as they would have been to the poorest medieval peasant. Now, that leads me to the third step in this. When the reigning language is the language of science and of empirical investigation, when that is the language of truth, then a kind of truth, I am the truth, that kind of language becomes vague, unpersuasive, and even unacceptable. This change in the uses of language, the diminishment in the opulence of the reference of language, this has become so vast that a whole science for the analysis of statements has arisen, and some of Professor Barrett's countrymen have made distinguished contributions to that craft. It's called the philosophy of language, or linguistic analysis. To put in ordinary words, it means, what does a sentence mean? When I say, God is love, a generation that has learned to judge the truth or falsity of a statement by experiment, hypothesis, experimentation, evidence, and proof, that language may be meaningless. It is usually dismissed by logical analysis as being an unintelligible statement, because they say to be an intelligible, that is, an understandable statement conveying sense, it would have to be verifiable. How do you know that God is love? Well, if I say, Jesus loves me, this I know, for the Bible tells me so, you're pushing the problem only one notch back further, because the Bible is no longer an unquestioned, uncritical authority. It has its incomparable role within the Christian community, and even on other grounds within the literary and cultural community. But as a teller of truth, it is not a teller of truth if truth is defined by a generation in empirical designative language terms. And therefore the situation has become crucial. The language people say, if you say God is love, that is a statement not capable of verification. There is no way you can verify that God is love. And there is nothing that an opponent could say that to the believer would falsify it. Nothing anyone says to me can falsify my conviction that God is love. Aha, therefore, they say, if no actual facts or events can be brought to the criticism of the statement, then it is not a statement conveying truth. It is an expostulation. You think God is, you feel God is love. You want to believe that God is love. You want to teach people that God is love. It is an unverifiable statement, because nothing, no evidence could ever change your mind. Nothing could falsify it. And therefore it is a purely subjective ejaculation, or an expostulation. Now, I'm going to lay this out flat, because that doesn't mean I believe all this, but that's what I would say three or four of the present generation of undergraduates, if we would see them across the nation or the world. This is the way they have been taught to use language to specify what things are true. Now, when only designative, verifiable, empirically guaranteed statements, such as you use in geometry, physics, chemistry, to a lesser degree in the social sciences, only when those statements are honored in the learned levels of society, in the university, in the colleges, and research places, and increasingly become part of our common inheritance, when that is the case, any reference to that which transcends that kind of designative possibility, any such reference remains a kind of subjective expostulation, incapable of objectivity or of subjection to critical analysis. Now, that being the case, we are in the situation that, again, I want to put as radically as I can. The day before yesterday, I said we are in now a predominantly secular age. The term comes from the Latin, which means within this time, locked within time, with a closed system. Secularism means the world of history and of nature and of human existence is a closed system. The world of nature is what it is. It is fired by nuclear energies. These have their own capacities for combination, combustion, heat and energy producing, and also for vaporizing and disappearing. But the world has its own apparently self-sustaining chain reaction. It's a closed system. To postulate that God or some force made it would not be denied by a scientist, because he has no way of verifying his denial. But neither would it be accredited as an intelligible statement, because it can't be proved. We would say, well, how do you account for all this? He would say, I cannot account for it. But neither would it be accredited as an intelligible statement, because it can't be proved. We would say, well, how do you account for all this? He would say, I cannot account for it, but I deal with the natural world as a closed system, having its energies and processes contained within it. I do not have to postulate God in order to get on with my business. So that, in a sense, up until very recently, most people received the word God as a meaningful term, or at least a word as a kind of finger pointing to some meaningfulness, some goodness or power or originative fountain of all life. Most people say then, I believe in God, or something like that. That is no longer the situation into which we will be preaching in the coming generation, because in most of my ministry, I could preach to people to whom the word God was a counter. It meant something. It had worth. It conveyed meaning. They could start thinking from the postulation, good old God, he's still there. He is. He is what I have learned, what the church, my mother, has taught me, what the Bible discloses. That's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and our Lord Jesus Christ. That's what the preacher means. Today, the word God for millions is simply a meaningless or unintelligible word which points to nothing. Now, as a result of that, there are movements going on in our culture which I haven't time, as I think indeed I have not the skill either, but certainly not the time to try to beat out tonight. But I want to just make a couple of statements. Despite all that, let me lay down as a notion for reflection and make no effort to defend it. Men will have meaning. And if I say men, will the women please excuse me? I'm an old duffer. I mean men and women, always. And I'm not about to change my grammar on the spot. When people will have meaning, if they cannot get a large or adequate meaning, they will settle for a gimmick or a trivial or a melody land meaning. If they cannot have a meaning that is adequate to the compass of life's nature, episodes, they'll settle for some meaning that is low enough to quiet their problem for the moment. This comes out in our common speech. When I hear the kids who still clog up my house because of the presence there of a couple of young people. I listen in on what goes on, and I try to make sense out of what I hear, which sometimes is a problem. But the language, the common language that the children use, the young people use, is often very significant in its carelessness. They report on one of their friends, what's happened to good old Lisa? What's she doing now? She's into macrame. Or Johnny is into, he's into ceramics. Or so-and-so is into this or into that. It means nothing commanding is into them. And they're settling for the vacancy thus created by getting into now this, now this, now this. Skiing or macrame or ceramics or truck driving or making unsalable pottery, all kinds of things. But my point is that people will have a meaning. Now, the old philosophers, as well as the fathers of the Christian faith, argued that men will have a meaning, they must have a meaning, for as Augustine said, thou hast formed us for thyself. Our hearts are restless till they rest in thee. I still believe it. But the formal statement is still true. They will have a meaning, not just because they are created in the image of God, though I still have meaning there for myself, but because the very constitution of the human being presses outwardly toward meaningfulness as an interior necessity. I would suggest that many mental disturbances, anxieties, breakdowns in personal life come because we try to feed ourselves on meanings which do not have the size of our anxieties and our needs. We try to answer great wonders and necessities with aspirin meanings. So that men, I lay it down as a postulate, men will have a meaning. And you have only to look around at the frenetic effort of the merchandising and entertaining world to satisfy those meanings with a whole battery of Los Angeles inventions, using but one I can think of, to anesthetize the terrible longing for meaning. Now I think the pathos of our meaninglessness may be the cradle of new and more adequate meanings. And instead of arguing that out abstractly, I want one of my former students to get up here from the podium, and while he's coming, I'll tell you why I've asked him to read what he's going to read, a very brief statement. John Berryman was a poet whose last years of his life were spent at the University of Minnesota. Some of you may have been there and know about him. He was an enormously gifted, skilled poet, a very sensitive human being. He was also a drunk. He was a great teacher when he was sober. He had had a tragic life in and out of mental institutions, but remained a master of language. He ended his life by jumping off the bridge in St. Paul 3 years ago. But before his death, he wrote 11 little things called 11 Addresses to the Lord. And I want you to hear it. And here you hear how a man, a child of all that I've spoken of, how this man gropes for a kind of meaning, and how with a certain wonderful skill he lays hold of ancient symbols and brings them into modern experience.
Master of beauty, craftsman of the snowflake, inimitable contriver, endower of earth so gorgeous and different from the boring moon, thank you for such as it is my gift. I have made up a morning prayer to you, containing with precision everything that most matters. According to thy will, the thing begins. It took me off and on 2 days. It does not aim at eloquence. You have come to my rescue again and again in my impassable, sometimes despairing years. You have allowed my brilliant friends to destroy themselves, and I am still here, severely damaged, but functioning. Unknowable, as I am unknown to my guinea pigs, how can I love you? I only as far as gratitude and awe, confidently and absolutely go. I have no idea whether we live again. It doesn't seem likely from either the scientific or the philosophical point of view, but certainly all things are possible to you, and I believe as fixedly in the resurrection appearances to Peter and to Paul as I believe I sit in this blue chair. Only that may have been a special case to establish their initiatory faith. Whatever your end may be, accept my amazement. May I stand until death forever at attention for any your least instruction or enlightenment. I even feel sure you will assist me again, master of insight and beauty.
Here is an interesting instance of a contemporary man whose mind has been formed by everything I've been talking about, whose sensibilities have been excruciatingly open to the changes, the tragedies and the delights, the achievements and the failures of contemporary life, and yet, almost at the moment of his death, he writes these little 11 addresses to the Lord, in which he talks about, you have come to my help again and again. You have permitted my brilliant friends to destroy themselves. And he, in the last apostrophe, he says, I can only talk about you as far as wonder and amazement go. Now may I suggest there's something theologically significant there. It seems to me that as knowledge deepens, wonder grows with it. As we know more, the circle of what we do not know becomes ever larger. As we look into the intricacies, not only of the natural world, and I do not mean to propose a God of the gaps, as we look into the intricacies of the natural world, and more profoundly, into the intricacies of contemporary, of life, not only ours, but all human life, something of the mystery of human existence grows along with the sophistication of logical analysis that says all statements about mystery and awe and wonder are meaningless statements. On one side of the street, linguistic analysis is telling us that evocative language has no meaning. On the other side of the street, right now, in modernity, in painting, in music, in literature, in many aspects of contemporary theology, a new sense of the human ambiguity, the human longing for meaning, is opening up for fresh proposals of old symbols of meaning. Now, I know what I'm talking about because in the little preaching I do now, it's mostly in college and university chapels, and I preach as if this analysis were true, and I don't find a thundering affirmative response to it, but I find an extraordinary young group of young people who are not typical chapel attenders want to say, what is that thing you read? Where did that come from? And the things they ask for are things formed by language which in their linguistic classes they have learned to believe are non-intelligible. So that I think a tide is turning in the sense that men will have meaning. We are gradually, I think, wearing out the surrogates for adequate meaning, which even 15 years ago were very important. And I think a fresh time has come. Now in the last time period, or the last part of the period I have, I want to do a final reflection which was engendered by that deeply felt, responsible, and craftsmanlike meditation that my colleague Professor Barrett gifted us with this morning. When from the book of Revelation he took big, powerful images and gave a kind of living testimony to their power and their efficacy and their meaning. Now, as I've reflected upon that since this morning, and encouraged to talk about it by three different persons who nailed me out there, I want to say as quickly as I can, what kind of affirmation of the truth of the Christian faith is possible for this new time? What kind of proclamation, what form and content of proclamation might be possible? Let me start with a little occasion. About a year ago, I was at a four-day conference held in a Roman Catholic convent in New Orleans. And on the way to the conference room, morning, afternoon, and evening, we passed the little chapel off the main corridor. And there I saw not the whole company of sisters, but always some, sitting in the chapel in complete silence, inert, quiet, wrapped in meditation. And in the front of the chapel was the old symbol of the cross, in fact a crucifix. And then I began to think, is there any other symbol in the world, any other form in the world that has been able for hundreds of years to catch, to hold the attention of millions, anything reflection upon which has engendered so massive a body of intellectual, emotional, devotional, probing, and literature, and thought, and feeling, and lived out lives as that symbol? Why has this figure been able to do that? If we really probe that question, I think we unlock something about the Christian faith which is very close to the heart of it. And some years ago I created a phrase for it which I think is still good. The form of the cross, the man on the cross, who was in his own understanding, intention, and poured out life, God's man. In that figure, you have something that absolutely intersects with the actuality of human existence. That is, our human existence has the form of a cross. Our human lives are cruciform. And therefore, when a proposal is made from the community of faith that there is the secret of life, the force of the proposal is in the congruity of that image with the way things are with us. Now let me try to fill out what I mean by the cruciform character of human existence. My moral life has a kind of cross at the heart of it, in the sense that I am incapable of an absolutely good action which has the dimensions of that goodness that I can envision and to which I'm called, but which I'm unable to do. That is, there's a sign of the cross on it. There is a pathos, a tragedy at the heart of moral existence, which no goodness of my own, no achievement, can ever quiet. Let me use almost a banal illustration, but it's so quick and so living and so common that you'll all catch it. I steal it from Gilbert Chesterton. Chesterton, who was a British essayist and lay theologian, about a couple of decades back, was an enormously fat man, and a man of huge Falstaffian humanity. And when he wrote theology, it was full of the humanity of all of us. Anyhow, Chesterton reflected one day and says, what do I mean when I say I love my wife? Well, first of all, I mean what I say. I do love my wife. And then when I think, what do I mean by saying I love my wife? Why do I love my wife? I am aware that the principal reason I love my wife is because she has the remarkable ability to reflect me back to myself at 7 times my normal size. Which means that my love of my wife is but a good and understandable human affection, but it is also an aspect of my absolute egocentricity. I love myself reflected back to myself at 7 times my normal size. And if she has this ability, her enlargement of my identity is highly pleasing to my identity. Or take another instance of what I mean by the cruciform character, that is the always the minus sign. Crossing the positive, there's always the negative. The cruciform character of moral existence. Certainly when one is saying his prayers, he ought to be as close to God as of his own devices he can come. And when I say prayers, my prayers are prayers with the community. I do say them, I mean them, and yet upon reflection, I know that there's an aspect of myself which is always congratulating myself for saying my prayers. And then hard upon that thought comes another. Ah, but if you really were a good Christian, you wouldn't congratulate yourself for being in the position of now saying your prayers. And then I think, aha, but if I were not really a good Christian, I would not know that I ought not to be congratulated. And the analysis goes on and on and on, so that there is disclosed by this kind of ethical realism the deep truth of Luther's statement. An awful statement, but awfully true. Man seeks himself in everything, even in God. I love God for my sake. Fundamentally, that I love God for what he is in himself, but never, my love is never as pure as the love with which I am beloved. I always find the love of God as, listen to the little homilies that you get in student gatherings. I love God for peace of mind, for serenity, for that blessed word, fulfillment. I love God because he is the giver of great gifts which are highly good for me and which I greatly desire. And there is nothing wrong about loving that which is a giver of gifts to you, to me. But let us have a kind of holy sense of humor about it. I do not love him purely. There's a hymn in our common service book of our churches ascribed to Thomas Aquinas. O God, I love thee, not that my pure love, poor love, would win me entrance to the heaven above, but for thou, what thou art, my thyself, I must love thee. That is what we ought, but are not able. And therefore, even in the deepest recesses of sound Christian devotion and thought, there is the mark of the cross. Now finally, we are born and we live, and in our life we move toward death. All life unfolds not toward an indefinite, ever more full experience, refinement, appreciation, but our life moves like a flower opening, and then in the evening closing in upon itself, so that we move toward death. The God who becomes my dying is the only kind of a God who's enough God, you see. A God who is simply a jolly object for Sunday morning celebration and hoopla. May be good for adolescent secretive systems, but will hardly be enough God for the Holy Catholic Church. The God who became sin for me, who became death for me, the God who becomes the lamb slain, is the only God who is enough for the pathos of death. We are hearing a melancholy lot, you know, these days about death as being simply an episode in natural life, as a kind of passing away. In fact, well, Christian ought to use that silly phrase, passing away. We don't say so-and-so died anymore, he passed away, or he passed on. Why don't we talk about death? Death is an awesome and a horrifying thing. As existentially not too far from it, I'm not going to try to kid myself. I believe in God. If we live, we are the Lord's. If we die, we are the Lord's. That will do for me, but nothing less than that will do. But death, nevertheless, is an awesome thing. I'm just now trying to gather together a little anthology of men's thoughts about death, and some of them are marvelous. You remember, particularly the young people here, Dylan Thomas, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should rage and rage at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." That's true. But if that be true, what is the kind of truth which has the magnitude to enclose it and to deal with it? Nothing less than a God who became the crucified one, the man who, the arc of whose life did not skim across my delights and celebrative moments or become simply a nylon blanket for my woes, but the God, the arc of whose life went in, down, through, under death itself and completed the arc on the other side. So that when we talk about on the throne is the Lamb who was slain, we come there to one figure that points to the truth of the Christian faith will be the adequacy of its proposals, the adequacy of its understanding of God and man and the world, which has a comprehensiveness and a congruity which somehow fits the arc of man's, both his delight and his pathos. And that is the only ultimate proof. And it is not capable of logical proof, but that it does not greatly matter if the other is true. I would not close this hour without saying to all of you how fine a time it's been to be with you, how extraordinary, really, has been the kind of attention you've given to my colleague and myself. Neither of us is entertainers and tried to take you very seriously. It's been a very moving and good experience, and I thank you.